Okay, this is scientific apologetics class number two. And for the guys that just came in, is this an extra one of yours? Okay, maybe we could pass this one back. Thank you. If you guys can share that one, that'd be awesome. If you could turn to page 20 in your outline, what we're going to do is we're kind of going to pick up a few pages after where we left off. And the reason is because I'm skipping a few pages where I was talking about the issue with in teaching intelligent design or, quote, creationism in the schools, and I didn't really want to go into that too much. And I'm just skipping through. So it says number two, recent scientific discoveries. That's where we're going to pick up. But to review a little bit, before we start, last week we introduced the class. We introduced this whole idea. And we talked about, can science prove whether or not a creator exists? Does science prove a creator exists? And we talked about how the first one, can science prove, is a philosophical question. And the second one, does science prove, is a scientific question. And so that delineation is very important because of the confusion that is out there in most of the public between or not knowing the difference between philosophy of science and science itself. And we also looked at this little table that I gave you. It was a worldviews comparison chart between the supernatural worldview and the naturalistic worldview. And hopefully you still have that. If you're new, you probably don't. So see me at the break and I'll give you that. And then we talked about the statistics that we see that were provided by the Pew Research poll that showed that Christians have varying beliefs that are extremely varied amongst ourselves in our beliefs about evolution and creation. And we also looked at how science, we saw in the statistics that science was very highly valued for non-Christians. They value science very highly. And so then we started to look at why is scientific apologetics important? And that's where we're going to pick up today. Why is scientific apologetics important? And the first reason was because of the confusion between philosophy of science and science. And the second reason is here. Recent scientific discoveries are quickly changing the understanding of the universe, ourselves, and God. So science has changed our world. And in the last 75 years, there's been more scientific ideas, theories, and discoveries than in the combined history of the entire human scientific enterprise. We've seen a lot of scientific ideas and discoveries in the last 75 years. And comparatively, these have caused a very rapid shift of ideas and worldviews. So people have shifted their way of thinking to different views based on the results of science. People have shifted their ways of thinking based on the results of science. And technological advances and tools of the last 75 years, such as the electron microscope, deep space satellites, these things have allowed us to discover what we were once ignorant of. And meaning that genes and DNA we now know about, we never knew about before. Fossil records we now know about, we never knew about before. Neanderthals and what people call hominid creatures. Hominid, if you're a Christian, you don't know what that is, you will. Well, we're going to get to that later. We've also learned about earthquakes and no longer attribute earthquakes to the bad reactions of the gods based on our bad behavior. So we've developed fields of seismology and meteorology where we learn about the weather. And this is all in the last 75 years. We've learned about the cosmological expansion constants of the universe. We've learned about dark matter. We've learned about quantum physics. We've learned about relativity theory. And most recently, last fall, we learned about the Higgs boson particle field, which I'm actually still not sure what that is. So I'm kind of behind. I spent so much time preparing these notes over the last 8 months. I really haven't got caught up to speed on that, but I know a little bit about it. But it's really interesting, I think, from what I know. And so these new scientific discoveries of the last 75 years have caused many in the academic and scientific community to reevaluate long-standing ideas. Experimental results have changed or replaced old theories. So we're seeing a shift, not just in how people approach science, but a shift in people's theories of science. For instance, the new cosmological Big Bang theory of origins replaced the steady state theories around 1950. And so the steady state theory of the universe was something that was pioneered by Fred Hoyle, who was a famous British cosmologist with these other guys. And this model was a contender to the Big Bang hypothesis. Many people held this view, but Hoyle really articulated it well and thought he had some good evidence to show its truth. And so these guys postulated that the universe was a continuous creation of matter that offset the expansion of the universe, resulting in a steady state. To the observer, the universe would always appear the same. So they just thought that matter was being created all over the place, all over the universe. Matter just popping into existence from something, black holes or something, stars, or just nothing. And so it was just this continuous creation. So Hoyle termed it steady state. And Hoyle said that material simply appears. The whole idea of creation is queer. Now, he didn't mean homosexual, he just meant strange. And so Hoyle thought that material appears out of nothing. Out of nothing. And does that sound familiar to anybody? Out of nothing. What is the Latin word for that?
Well, no, pair production.
Sorry?
Pair production.
Pair production?
Yeah. It's when part one is part whole, and the creation of part without.
This is what you're saying Hoyle is referring to?
No, it's just something.
Okay, right. So the Latin is what I was looking for, but that's cool. The Latin was ex nihilo, which is the term that theologians use to describe God's creation of the universe. God created ex nihilo. Out of nothing is what that stands for. And this is comparable, like I just said, to the Jewish, Christian, Muslim idea or understanding that God created the material of the universe out of nothing. But in Hoyle's case, he thought that the new material of the universe just continuously appears, and nothing, according to him, causes it to do so. And so this was the dominant view of the origin of the universe at the time. This view was dismissed by the scientific community later on in favor of the more dominant Big Bang theory, which Hoyle actually unknowingly coined. He coined the term Big Bang Theory, even though he was a proponent of the steady state model. And he was criticizing it, and so he called it Big Bang Theory because he was kind of showing critique of it. And that name stuck. And so for the last 60 years or so, most scientists hold to the Big Bang model of the universe. Now, we're not going to get into the Big Bang right now, but I'm just presenting that as an example of how theories shift over time as a result of different scientific discoveries and finds. And so even newer scientific finds of the last 25 years present cosmologists with an opportunity to revise or generate entirely new theories of the universe. So some of the new theories of the universe that we have are the multiverse theory, that there are multiple universes, not just one. There's multiple. And so they call it multiverse. And then we have the black hole created universe theory, that black holes create universes. And then we have this boundless finite universe. And this theory was advocated by Stephen Hawking. And I think he may still advocate that, I'm not sure. The bounce hypothesis is another theory, and then an M theory. And so these are even newer theories that we see in science. And so these current theories are intriguing and are the results of years of research by some of the brightest scientific minds of our time. We have Einsteins living amongst us today that will go down in history as some of the most brilliant scientists ever. And they are some of the folks that are coming up with these theories. And so we will actually address some of these theories later in this class, probably 5 or 6 weeks from now. And we're going to look at them a little bit in detail and talk about them and how it makes sense or it doesn't make sense. And so the discoveries of our time plant ideas in the minds of people all around the world about our place in such a fascinating and beautiful universe and on such an exotic and varying planet. we start to think about ourselves. How do we fit into this picture that we are getting from science? The latest discoveries are truly awe-inspiring and, in a sense, earth-shaking. Have you ever looked at some of the results from NASA, maybe on NASA's webpage or there's a NASA channel? I mean, some of this stuff is just so amazing, and you just stare at it and you're just like blown away by it. It just, there's no words to describe it, and all it is a picture. You know, it doesn't even do it justice, I'm sure, to being there, seeing it for yourself. But these discoveries and newer theories come from ideas. And what I'm proposing here with this little graphic is not some dead set rule. This is kind of sociology, and I'm not a sociologist, I'm an engineer. So I'm kind of in the middle of all of this. And what I mean is that science, a science idea or a science observation, eventually gets to become a theory. This is maybe what you would get out of the scientific process or the scientific method. And then you get to, out of a theory, you get to engineering and design. So you start designing things so they will hold up, for instance, to gravity. So we have a theory of gravity after scientific observations, and we start thinking of ways to put roofs over our heads so they don't fall down and kill us in the night and keep the rain off of us. So we engineer and we design a solution. And then this basically produces technology and production. You get production out of engineering and technology. And so you can start making hammers and saws, and you can start getting rigs together to quickly build houses. And then that essentially eventually produces culture change and questions. People start questioning, why are we building houses? Why are we building them like this? Shouldn't we be building them bigger? Shouldn't we be building them smaller? And don't we want to have a lot of smaller houses so we can have more people closer to, say, the river? Or bigger houses so we have more space and we're not always on, you know, so close to each other, getting annoyed with each other. And so we start to ask these questions about ourselves and our culture. And then eventually, beliefs and values begin to change. So communities that are interacting in these houses, if they're spread apart or closer together with no backyards or big backyards, it kind of starts developing a whole a value system for that community. And so people maybe think, oh, well, we should have a dense population with loft-style houses, a business is on the first floor, and it's a more city life, and people can get out and walk around and kind of be city dwellers, and singles can interact more often and don't feel overrun by families with little kids, you know, something like this. Or the families are like, no, we want to have, you know, a big, fat, 4,000 square foot house and live next to a park and a little school, and it needs to be a good school, even though we don't have kids because we don't want kids because we're, I won't get into that. But anyway, you get the idea, is that beliefs and values change, but it really could be traced back to science, ideas from science. And of course, I'm painting with a broad brush here. I'm not a sociologist, but I live in the middle of that. I'm an engineer, so I design buildings, and I hear all these extremes from the belief and value change side of how it affects society to, you know, are we designing with the right materials? Are we using the right fundamentals of physics and things like that? So I kind of have a little bit of a glimpse of this. And what my point is that science is the origination of technology, but more importantly, that science ideas eventually, through technological change, they change culture. Science ideas change culture. And so scientific discoveries of our world have changed our worldviews. They've affected us. We think differently because of science. And our perspective of ourselves and the reasons for our existence come into question when evaluating scientific finds. And we are faced with personal and collective existential questions due to science experiments and theories. We ask, what are we here for? How did we get here? Where are we going? And so how does each one of us answer these questions when we're faced with the results of science? How do we think about that? You don't have to answer. I'm just being rhetorical here. And after a time of scientific progress, a generation becomes adapted to technological advances and reevaluates culture with lots of questions. Then beliefs start to change. And so what has been very interesting over the last 75 years is that academics and scientists and the rest of us have become faced with the questions of whether or not a God caused it all or fits into all of this new scientific discovery. Whether or not a God caused it all or he somehow fits into it all. And the Christian and public are faced with the same questions. We have to wrestle with these questions, all of us, with the results of science. And the public response varies for sure, but like I said, when anyone sees an image from a distant galaxy, most of the time we stand in awe, Christian or not. There's a sense of wonder about it, a curiosity. And so how have the scientific community, how have they responded to the newest discoveries? As scientific discoveries come so rapidly, more academics and scientists are publicly open to the idea that God or a higher power or a higher being exists. Many are now very comfortable revealing that they are Christian or Catholic to their fellow scholars. So more scientists are open about this. In the past, the 50s and 60s, that wasn't the case. You just went to church on Sunday, but you didn't tell anybody. You know, you didn't share that openly. And again, I'm painting with a broad brush here, but we're seeing more scientists being comfortable and public with their religious convictions. And philosopher Alistair McGrath noted this. He said, "This fundamental shift in the scientific consensus has changed the tone of the debate about God." Okay? It reminds us of how science changes its mind about things, often very important things, just meaning that the discoveries change theories as time passes. And the cosmology of the 21st century is much more sympathetic to Christian belief than that of a century ago. So he's saying that it seems that when we look at the cosmology that's been given to us by the scientists, there's a lot more room for the Christian worldview to make sense than in the past. There is now a growing realization that the universe came from came into being fine-tuned for life. Is this just a cosmic accident? Or is it what we would expect if God had chosen to work this way? Is this just a cosmic accident? Or is it something that we'd expect if God did it? I'm so sorry about that. I don't know exactly what's causing it. I apologize. The world is rapidly changing, is a rapidly changing place that, thanks to the rapid advances in current science, and although scientific theories about the universe have changed to become hopefully more accurate, which we all think they have, Christians are not left behind on the fast track. And so Christians, we have a place in these scientific discoveries. We're not just left out. And there was once a time when Christians and everyone else thought that the sun revolved around the earth. And the universe revolved around the earth. And this has stereotyped Christians as being too relevant for centuries. And we, at the time, Christians were just thinking the same way everyone else was thinking about the universe, that the sun revolved around the earth. Everybody thought that, Christian or not. And the Catholic Church chastised Galileo for his discoveries and Copernicus. And unfortunately, Christians have been given this stereotype that we've been anti-science ever since. Or we've been anti-science the whole time because allegedly the Bible reports, allegedly, that the sun revolves around the earth. But the Bible never says that. The Bible never says that. You can look in there and check it out. The reason I think people think we think that is because of the Joshua passage, which we talked about last year, and how it says that Joshua prayed for the sun to stand still in the sky. And I argued that was... that's not what it's not saying that the sun revolved around the earth. It just said this, he prayed that to stand still. And it doesn't mean that that is what the Bible was teaching, nor does it mean that Joshua was literally wanting the sun to stop in the sky but I argued last year that he was praying for more time. He was praying for more time, not necessarily for a longer day. But anyway, that's a whole other conversation. And so this idea was never in Scripture, and it's not in Scripture now, that the sun revolved around the earth. So Christians should not believe in a bad scientific system, nor should we accept that the Bible teaches the sun revolves around the earth. And we need to, as Christians, we've got to know if our scientific worldview aligns with reality. We can't just hide in a box, like we talked about last week, or sheepishly walking back from the public square. If it doesn't, we must find out why and not stop till we figure out the answers. And I'm talking about our worldview. We've got to figure it out. We can't just stop until we figure it out. And this class will help in that effort, and I know you will come away with several answers, and it may raise several more questions this class, but I know you'll get more answers. It turns out that we do, in fact, have a belief system that can accommodate the rapid changes of science, and our belief system matches reality, and I'm going to present that in this class for us. It turns out that our scriptures do, in fact, teach what we observe in science. It teaches the beauty, the handiwork, and the care and detail of the Creator God that we see in nature. And again, we're going to get more into this in the class. And it turns out that Christian philosophy of science is actually coherent with science, and science is continuously validating it. And we'll discuss this more in detail, but for example, in philosophy, Christians have their own arguments for the existence of God that are philosophical in nature, and one of them goes like this. You can see this here, and I want you to take note of this, so I'm particularly putting that there. That whatever begins to exist has a cause. That's the first premise of this line of reasoning. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. And so, while that seems like so basic, it's actually quite profound when you get into the whole details of that argument. Because what happens after that is that you get a line of reasoning that infers an intelligent agent is behind the cause. And we don't want to get into the intricacies of this argument because we're going to get into that in the philosophical class that should be later on this year or next year. But right now we could look at premise two of this and say the universe began to exist before, in the steady state model, which many people held that weren't Christians, many people held that view. This line of reasoning would have been repulsive to them. The universe has the universe began to exist. That would have been repulsive. They said, no, it doesn't. You're crazy, Christian. You're crazy. The universe didn't begin to exist. It's been a steady state model. They may not say you're crazy. They may say that idea is crazy or something. But they would have been adamantly opposed to that idea because they thought the universe had a steady state environment. And so now we can point to this and say, look, we were right. The universe did begin to exist. And everyone in the scientific community, or a lot of scientists, I should say, hold to this position that the universe began to exist from a Big Bang. So what I'm saying here is that the Christian worldview is now validated by science, whereas before it was opposed to it. So and what I'm saying is that science has finally caught up to us, whereas before, many held to a steady-state universe. And Big Bang cosmology is a view that the Christian can adopt and accept, and we'll talk about this later. Now, you may be sitting here as a Christian saying, no way, the Big Bang did not cause this universe. God caused it 6,000 years ago in 6 days. And you may be foaming out the mouth, you know, wanting to beat me up right now. I'm not saying I hold this position. I'm just saying that Christians can adopt and accept this position. They can. It's allowed in a Christian worldview that corresponds with good, sound biblical theology. It's accounted for in the Christian system that the Big Bang occurred. Now, I'm not getting into the details of the Big Bang. We're going to get to that 8 weeks from now. But I'm whetting your appetite. Again, these first two classes are introductory in nature, and I'm throwing a lot at you. And I'm not giving you evidence for what I'm saying, but I'm just presenting you with where we're going in a nutshell, so you can kind of get a glimpse of this. And either way, Christians believe that God created the universe so it began to exist. So while this conclusion seems elementary, it's quite profound. And it's more profound when you think of the physics and when you think of the concept of time itself initiating from this moment in an infinitesimal point in space. So again, we'll talk about time later, but time is quite profound if you ever thought about time itself. So again, it turns out that the Christian philosophy of science is coherent with science in this sense, with the Big Bang cosmology, and we have this idea that God created the universe. It's coherent. We have a Christian philosophy that it's coherent with these two things. It's coherent with the results of science. And what I'm arguing is science is continuously validating the Christian worldview. And Christianity is well capable of handling anything that science comes up with. Why do I say that? I'm saying that just because science is a very big and powerful enterprise. Science is huge. It's massive. It's weighty. It weighs on us all. But Christianity endures through time. It endures. And it will continue to do so. Christianity is, in this sense, intellectually deeply profound in a way that science can't relate to. We will discuss the limits of science later, and what I mean by that is I'm not saying that science isn't profound. I'm just saying Christianity is profound in a different way. It's profound. The Christian belief system is unbelievably amazing. And I hope that you as a Christian can accept that for the Christians that are in here. And for the non-Christians in here, I hope that you understand that too. That the Christian belief system is not simplistic. It is complicated, complex, and profound. But the cool thing is, it all is coherent within itself and relates to reality. And the Christian truth does not have to be compromised by new discoveries of science. Christian truth can absorb any new find and any new theory with perfect dignity and no compromise. Now, that is debatable, I know. But what I will argue in this class, and what we'll see, is that the Christian perspective can accommodate these new results of science, or else the Christian perspective is not correct, or the science results are not correct. Both, one of them has to be right if there's a conflict. But what I'm arguing is that if the science is done right and the results are interpreted right, and the Christian theology is correct, then both will jive and there will not be a conflict because it's the same source of truth. We'll talk about that later. And I'm asking, can the atheist philosophy and other world religions keep up with science like the Christian worldview can? I'm going to ask that. I don't know, but I question that. Maybe they can. In fact, based on my understanding, the atheist perspective, and I'm not an atheist and I don't know it perfectly, but I'm not so sure that the atheist perspective can keep up with science like Christianity can. Now that's arguable, that's debatable, I know. But I'm just saying, it seems to me that the results of science is pointing more towards a creator. And this is what we will argue in this class. This is what will be presented. That the Christian worldview accounts for all this science. And maybe the atheist worldview does too. So we'll see. But for Christianity, no recent or new theory can beat it up, knock it down, or defeat it. Christians, we're not defeated. We have some good science that backs up our view. And I want you to be encouraged about that. And this is one of the most fascinating parts of being a Christian, is that we don't have to be afraid of any type of intelligence, whether it comes from science or philosophy or what. Because we have centuries of thought behind us, and we have the thinker who made it all. He's teaching us. That's what we believe as Christians, that God is helping us think about this. Now, hopefully, the Christian is open-minded enough to consider the non-Christian scientist interpretation. So you may have a Christian scientist saying one thing, you have a non-Christian scientist saying something different. They may be saying the same thing. I'm just saying that as Christians, just because we're Christian, doesn't mean that we go and say, look, there's a Christian scientist and he's saying intelligent design, so we're right. You know, that's not how it works. And we talked about following the evidence where it leads last time, like Anthony Flew, the atheist philosopher we talked about. We want to be like him. We want to say, where does the evidence lead? And consider our position in light of the evidence as much as we can. Get outside of our Christian bubble and follow the evidence where it leads. And what I'm arguing and what I'm trying to explain tonight is that when we do that, the Christian worldview is presented very coherently with those results. So the question for the Christian and the non-Christian is, are we open to observing and receiving what the Creator of it all is revealing? In this class, if you're Christian or not, are you open to revealing, to receiving what the Creator of it all is revealing? That's what I want to ask us tonight. And this is kind of the end of the introduction here. And now we're going to get into the stuff, but we're going to take a little break. But the point of this last little section is, why is scientific apologetics now? Why is it important? It's because the recent scientific discoveries are calling into question mankind's place and purpose and whether or not God fits into this picture at all. And so it's time, now is the time, like never before, to look into the results of science and see what they have to say, see what they have to teach us about reality, ourselves, and God. And so, are there any questions about that? And you could always interrupt with a question, just raise your hand. If not, we'll go ahead and take a little break for 5 minutes, come back. Yes, sir.
I'm just kind of curious about the reference to raw material is to the Christian. I'm kind of curious why that chose to be versus just simply the church, the theists.
That's a good question. Why did I use the word Christian here and there all over the place instead of theist? I think it's just because at the end of the day, I'm arguing for the Christian worldview, which is above and beyond the theist worldview. I'm actually being less modest. I'm saying not only does science back up theism, but it backs up Christianity. And that's more of a bold claim, and I realize that. But I'm confident enough to make that case. And when we come back after the break, I'm going to show you this argument that we're going to go through as a class together for the whole course. And so I don't want to get into it right now, but great question. Now, I could just say, if you're in here and you want to take out the word Christian or Christianity and put the word theist or theism, that's fine. You can do that too. But it's less modest, but it's a little bit more easy to see. But the fourth premise of my argument, you'll see, it more points towards Christianity beyond theism. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, so what we'll do is we'll take a little break, and there are snacks in the back, and I'm just going to ask you to do something for me. If you can, just humor me, turn to your neighbor, create a little love group, and ask each other, what scientific discovery of the past, say, 75 years has stood out to you, and why does it stand out? What was your reaction to it when you first heard of it? Something like that. And you may not have to have something profound, but it could be something you saw on TV or something. Okay? What scientific discovery has stood out to you over the last 75 years, and what was your reaction to it? Okay? Can we do that? Thank you. Let's get going here. All of these people are so talkative. People that didn't even know each other before are just best friends now. Little love groups have formed. Ryan loves them. Love groups, Ryan. Love, accept it. Accept it. Okay, let's get going here. If you turn to page... All right, if you turn to page 28, are there any in here who are at this scientific apologetics class and you have no idea what the word apologetics is? Raise your hand if you're a little vague on this idea of apologetics. A couple of us? Okay, I'm not going to go over this these next two pages in detail, but I'll read a few definitions for us. First, apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia, or apologetikos, which can be translated from reason or suitable for defense. Okay, and there's a little bit of the translation. So from reason or suitable for defense. So we're not giving an apology that we're sorry for being Christians, we're sorry for smelling so bad, we're sorry for not being so smart, whatever. We're just saying this is my these are the reasons for my defense of this position. Apologetics is the systematic and logical defense of Christianity against its detractors and unbelievers, backed up by evidence showing its credibility. And what I mean by that is that people that object to Christianity or show Christianity to be flawed, attempt to show it to be flawed, present evidence for their position. So apologetics presents evidence for the Christian position that is able to be coherent, logical, systematic, and so forth. And apologetics seeks to show that Christianity is the most viable, compelling, and true way of living and experiencing reality. Now that's a big statement. What do I mean? I'm just saying that it seeks to show that Christianity corresponds with reality better than any other worldview or set of beliefs. That the Christian worldview and religion is true. It corresponds with reality. There's this concept of, in philosophy, known as the correspondence theory of truth. That if my belief corresponds with the actual world out there, then I have an accurate belief. My belief is in fact correct because it corresponds with reality. And so what I'm saying is that if the Christian belief system corresponds with reality, and reality is really how the Christians say it is, then we are, in a sense, living a very accurate lifestyle. Because it's accurate to reality. Does that help? We don't have to go through all of these, but number five there, apologetics asks the question, why and how do you believe what you believe? So to the Christian, apologetics is helpful. It's very helpful. The Christian is faced with the question, why do you believe Jesus died on the cross for the forgiveness of your sins so that you can have enter the kingdom of God? Why do you believe that? I know that you do believe it, but why? What evidence do you have? You can't say blind faith because that's not biblical. What evidence supports your belief that there is a guy named Jesus, he died on the cross, and you have these things called sins, and they were forgiven, and there's this thing called the kingdom of God, and you're going to go into it, or you're into it now? Why? You've got to tell me why with reasons and evidence. Otherwise, your belief system's incoherent. It's a mess. And so the apologetics helps the Christian to formulate his belief system, hopefully, with logic and reasons and evidence. And so, and on to the next page, just a couple of these definitions of apologetics. Sometimes there's unbelievers who are hostile to Christianity. Not all unbelievers. In fact, a lot of believers like Christianity. But some unbelievers like Christianity. But some unbelievers, like guys like these new atheist types, they present their position with some passion. And it comes across sometimes as angry. I don't know if they're really angry, but sometimes it comes across hostile to the Christian. And maybe unintentionally, but that's kind of how sometimes Christians perceive it. And so apologetics helps disarm that hostility, that negative interaction. And it doesn't have to be negative. The conversation between, the Christian and the non-Christian could be one of wonderful engagement. And there doesn't have to be hostility at all. And the proper use of apologetics could disarm that conversation from being such a battle, you know, weapons firing at each other. It doesn't have to be like that. It helps present a proper use of apologetics prevents the unbeliever from accusing Christianity of being intellectually foolish. Sometimes non-Christians could say that Christianity is foolish. Not a lot of non-Christians will say that, but some will. And let me read to you this email I got this last week. I'll read just parts of it. He's talking about Christians. Since they seem set on ignoring logic and common sense, that was the end of a sentence. Let's face it, religion is based on things that are not logical, such as miracles, supernatural, and invisible things that are never based on any evidence. By nature, these things are not logical or based on real things. If I actually thought Christians were open-minded, sincere, and willing to approach the debate respecting logic, then I would go to the class. But then, why would someone who believes in an invisible God hold these values, logic and such? And then he goes on to say, science, I responded just briefly because I didn't have a lot of time, unfortunately, but he goes on to say, science deals with physical evidence, whereas religion creates ideas of things that are intangible and therefore not perceivable. What evidence do you have that there is a God? If you can give no tangible evidence for God, how can it be possible to show that God is real or part of reality? I believe that what is around us all has always been here in some way, shape, or form. Kind of like that steady state model. And that there was never a beginning to anything. Only that things have changed from one form to another. So that's that position, the steady state position. So you heard in there at the very beginning that he didn't think Christians were logical. And so what I'm saying, that apologetics allows someone who has that view to be proven wrong, that Christians are logical. And so what else? Let's skip down to 11 there. Apologetics is not merely about winning an argument. This is just what it means. This is just the means to the end of winning souls for the kingdom. So apologetics is an evangelistic tool for talking with a non-Christian. So it's helpful because it allows what I'm saying here in 12, it allows one to have direct access to Jesus by removing intellectual barriers. And this is for the Christian and non-Christian. Christians have intellectual barriers too. But it allows direct access to Jesus by removing intellectual barriers, bringing down the walls that we have installed so we can see Jesus face to face. So the Christian and non-Christian sometimes have these walls. And sometimes we're in church and we can't worship. Sometimes we can't read our Bible because we are stuck behind this issue. We can't get past. It's an intellectual barricade, if you will. And so apologetics is just how to think about things to bring down those walls. And at the end of the day, the goal is to see Jesus face to face for the Christian and the non-Christian. And so that's kind of the idea. Anybody have any question on what apologetics is? Still? Okay, so again, this is not about arguing. Apologetics is not that. And apologetics is not about just bringing someone to Jesus. That's not it at all. But it's about helping the Christian and non-Christian have a way to establish faith or enhance faith. It's a way to provide that. And at the end of the day, the goal is to bring down all of our walls. I still have doubts. I still struggle with some concepts. But I'm, like I said last year, I'm 90% sure, beyond a reasonable doubt, at this point, that the Christian worldview is coherent and corresponds with reality. But there are some things I question. And so it's natural. So doubts are good. So apologetics is not about just removing all doubt. It's not that at all. And so it's for both the Christian and non-Christian equally. So don't hear me say that, you're not hearing me say that it's about winning an argument or creating arguments. It's not about that. It's about bringing down our own walls, and then eventually maybe we could help someone with their walls. Okay, next page. You have three more pages there. And what I want to do, because I want to give you good stuff. And what I gave you last week was not so good. It had some errors. And so I'm really concerned about it. So I would love it if you could take out the last three sheets of your outline and just fold them in half and set them to the side. And what I want to do is pass out these new three sheets, which have a little, a tiny bit of revisions. Yeah, the last three sheets, 31 through 33, the last three sheets. And if you could just take a chunk of these and just, yeah, fold them up and set them aside. We're going to throw them away, recycle them. Sorry, 30 through 33. Yeah, so just take three and pass them down. Thank you.
30 through 33.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. So you guys just need two on this row. Oh, you want one for her too? Okay, here's one for her. Okay. Now, I was debating on whether to do that or not. Here's some more. Did you get some? If you could just fold the old ones in half so you don't get confused, the new one will have a blank, some blanks for you to fill in on it, and we'll fill in the blanks as we go. I'm very sorry. I didn't mean for you to have to do that, but I'm honestly very concerned about giving you good information. I work very hard to help this class be as best as possible. So, we'll just bear with me. Okay, so we're looking at page 30. What does scientific apologetics do? What is this for? What are we doing? Well, what is it going to give us? Well, number one, scientific apologetics provides reasons for rejecting the worldview or philosophy known as scientism or naturalism. It provides reasons. It seeks to answer the question, is there more to nature than law and chance? So it provides reasons for rejecting those worldviews. And it emphasizes, number two, the integration view as opposed to the conflict view. It emphasizes the integration view as opposed to the conflict view. Does anybody need any more of these? Okay. And it answers the question, are science and religion conflicting disciplines? So the idea here is to understand the relationship, the appropriate relationship between science and religion. It doesn't have to be one of conflict, and we'll get into that later. It demonstrates how the inductive scientific method yields knowledge similar to the inductive method of other disciplines. So it demonstrates the inductive method in science and how that's similar to other disciplines. And it asks the question, or it answers the question, does the scientific method yield results that are contrary to Christian theology? For instance, does a brain experiment yield results that humans do not have souls? Okay, so the idea with that is that, I'll get into that later, but that's an example. It uses scientific data to create a case for an intelligent designer, or a case for the existence of God. But it uses scientific data to create that case. So that's what scientific apologetics will do. And last, it seeks to understand and discern biblical passages and scientific data. So it looks at the Bible and says, what does the Bible say about this stuff? And how are we supposed to understand the Bible? And it answers the question, are the events in Genesis congruent with the age of the earth? What is the age of the earth? Does Genesis talk about the age of the earth? Does it describe a young earth or an old earth? And we'll get into that at the very end of the class. Now, I talked about the structure of the argument. What I've tried to do here is to help us all, including myself, think about how to show this thesis. Science independently supports the Christian worldview. That's my thesis for this whole class. And I hope that would be your thesis too. science independently supports the Christian worldview. And I'm arguing for that thesis with these premises. And I'm forming an inductive case. Premise one, scientism and naturalism are easily defeated and ought to be rejected. That's what I'm first arguing. So the class is going to be broken up into four parts. These are the four parts. And each part will be a couple weeks, give or take. And the first chunk of the class is going to be showing the truth of this first premise. And that's a big premise to make, so it's pretty bold. Secondly, I'm saying that, or we're saying as Christians, this is how the Christian worldview is usually presented. This is a similar argument to what you'll get in any type of scientific apologetics curriculum. Science and Christianity are not in conflict, but are better understood as integrated sources of knowledge. So we're going to show that how these two disciplines are not in conflict, but we could better understand them as integrated sources of knowledge if they're both describing the same reality. They ought to have integrated results. And third, intelligent design is inferred, I-N-F-E-R-R-E-D, as the most plausible explanation of scientific observations. I'm saying it's inferred as the most plausible explanation of these observations we have. One can infer very plausibly out of all the competing ideas that intelligent design is there. And fourth, biblically based Christian views are harmonious with scientific observations. Harmonious, like harmony. They're in harmony with observations. So I'm saying if you have a Bible-based view, what I'm saying is that view is considered, in the Christian worldview, harmonious with scientific observations. So, I'm throwing this out there. It's simplistic at this point, but we're going to get into it. So based on these four premises, science independently supports the Christian worldview. Now, on the second page, or the next page, and I'll pass out a little bit more of the next handout here shortly, but what I'm doing here is I'm expanding the structure for you, because this is where we're going. And I want you, in fact, to take these two pages, 32 and 33, pull them out, and put them in the flap of your binder. Well, we're going to look at them first, but put them there because during the course, it's going to get a little... We're going to get deep into this stuff, and I want you to be able to understand where you are at in the flow of the argument. And so the argument, this class, is presented in a way where we're all together looking at the presentation for the Christian worldview backed by science, and we're going to say that, yes, it is backed by science at the end of the day. That's the approach. And in doing that, we're giving ourselves topics to study. So it's a flow of thought that presents the Christian worldview, but it's also a group of topics. And we're going to kind of use this as our topical outline. So these two pages could be your nice outline that you could refer to on the side. Now, so premise one again, scientism and naturalism are easily defeated and ought to be rejected. And I'm giving you six supporting premises for that. Defining scientism and naturalism shows that these worldviews are questionable and seem too limited. Just in the definition of what these things are, they're questionable. These worldviews are questionable. There's something to these worldviews that seem too limited, right off the cuff. And second, the scientific method in and of itself does not necessitate naturalism as a worldview. Just by doing the scientific method, I don't get naturalism, the worldview known as naturalism. And then third, there are legitimate problems with empiricism. Now, we're going to get into what that is, but I'm throwing that in there because that's kind of part of the scientific method and how the scientific method was developed and so forth. And fourth, there are legitimate problems with naturalism and scientism. So I'm going to show that there are about 8 or 9 problems with those worldviews. And then fifth, alternate philosophies of science are more realistic and favorable than naturalism. And scientism too, but I didn't write it there. So I'm going to say there's better philosophies of science than naturalism and scientism. And then I'm going to say that good models for secular and Christian scientists can be maintained without naturalism. So science can just do its thing, but you don't have to have a naturalistic worldview. Okay? And so if you sum up all those premises, induction will help us, and we can see that the truth of premise one is supported. Now, if I argue for the truth of all these premises, and they do actually present themselves to be valid in their flow, then we have a sound, what's called a sound argument. We have something that, or sound reasoning. And so that's what these supporting premises do. And in premise two, science and Christianity are not in conflict, but are better understood as integrated sources of knowledge. I'm presenting these sub-premises to support that premise. The breakdown of each view shows that the integration view is realistic and favorable, rather than the conflict view. I'm saying that the integration view is actually preferred, for Christian or not. And so I'm saying also here that to discuss the issues of science and Christianity, it is important for the Christians and non-Christians to understand both correctly. A lot of times, Christians just don't understand science well. And we need to understand Christianity and science well. And some scientific disciplines, including quantum physics, for instance, are studied, researched, developed, and taught similarly to Christian branches of theology, such as the Christian branch of theology known as Christology, which deals with the dual nature of Christ. And so I'm saying that the way these things flow through history, including quantum physics, or I'll use that as an example, they have a flow that's similar to each other. Christianity or Christian theology and quantum physics, we're going to see how they developed is actually a similar development. And this supports this idea that it's an integrated source of knowledge. Not directly, but indirectly. Okay. And then premise three, intelligent design is inferred as the most plausible explanation of scientific observations. I'm saying that, and other Christian apologists will say the same thing, ID, intelligent design, is inferred in biochemistry when considering the specified complexity and irreducible complexity in the cell. So I'm saying the idea is inferred from that, from biochemistry. And idea is inferred in classical physics when observing the transparency and beauty of the universe. And I'm saying the idea is inferred from astrophysics when observing the finely tuned universe. So astrophysics. So biochemistry, classical physics, and astrophysics. So that's where we're going. And that's what's being presented. And now, that's where we're going to get into the hard science stuff. Okay, premise four. Biblically based Christian views are harmonious with scientific observations. Now, if you look here at this little chart, on the left-hand side, you see natural creation, and there's various views for that. Typically, a lot of times, the view is Big Bang cosmology and evolution. And then over in the middle, you see this idea of supernatural creation with intelligent design. And then on the right, you have this idea of no creation, which is this steady state model. And in the middle, again, you have the young earth and old earth views. In the young earth, you have flood geology and the ideal time theory. And in the old earth view, you have these views called progressive creation and theistic evolution. And then there's a bunch of other less popular views. But in the two more popular ones, progressive creation and theistic evolution, you have all of these sub-views. And the RTB model and the Dage theory, fully gifted creationism, evolutionary creationism, are also supported or argued as part of the old earth perspective. So if you're an old earther and you hold one of these views, we're going to get into that. If you're a young earther and you hold the young earth view, we're going to talk about that too. Not necessarily say one view is more as... I'm going to not say anything about that because I don't want to throw people off just yet. But we're going to try to look at both views and see which views are better in saying that they're biblically based. Which views are biblically based. And so we'll get to that at the end. So those are the four parts of this class. And interestingly, there are those that hold to an evolutionary, theistic evolution or evolutionary creationist model that adopt full-on natural selection as proposed by Darwin. And so those proponents will argue that this process is the process God used to establish the species over time. And this, they argue, is held as biblically based. And the other progressive creationist views there are a little different than that. So we'll get into the details and assess the problems of each of those. Okay, any questions on this flow of thought or where we're going? All right. Now, I have the next handout to pass out. Let's see. Let's do this. Let me ask you this. It's 8:35. We typically end around 8:45. Would you like to go on for another 10 minutes into the new handout, or would you like to stop here and let the new handout start next week? Show of hands, who would like to keep going for 10 more minutes? Who would like to just go for it next week? Okay, some of you didn't vote. We'll keep going. Any questions while I pass these out? Okay. You'll have it shortly. Thank you. Thank you. Now, so far I've thrown just a lot at you the last week and a half. I've just thrown a bunch of crazy statements at you. And I appreciate you flowing this introduction because there's been a lot of, I think, thought-provoking things that were said. And so we're going to hash it all out now. We're going to hash it all out. And we're going to see if we can present the Christian worldview with these premises. Okay, page one. The first premise. Premise one, scientism and naturalism are easily defeated and ought to be rejected. Now, defining scientism and naturalism shows that these worldviews are questionable and seem too limited. So that's what I'm saying at the introduction here, that these worldviews are questionable and limited. Now, I'm not saying science is questionable. I'm not saying nature is questionable. I'm saying the worldview known as scientism and the worldview known as naturalism are questionable and seem limited just by their definition. So the dominant Western philosophies of science are typically naturalism and scientism. These are the views most people will hold. I mean, not everybody, but a lot of people hold these views. And so when we look at naturalism and what it is, we can break it down in three different definitions. We're going to get deep into this now. The universe requires no supernatural cause, but is self-existent, self-explanatory, self-generating, and self-directing. That's the first part of the definition. Self-existent, self-explanatory, self-operating, and self-directing. Self-existent, self-explanatory, self-generating, and self-directing. Now, all I'm doing here is I'm just defining it. And these aren't my definitions. I'll tell you more about where I get this stuff. But there's a lot of books in the back that again, are written by Christians and non-Christians that support these definitions. Yes, sir?
If there's a dry erase marker or something,
yes.
It's kind of cool if you could write the words down on there because I'm not fast at writing.
Right on. Self-existent.
Oh, you
probably can't see that, can you?
Cut the board in half and then do whatever page we're working on now and then do whatever page the next page and then erase that one and then go back
got
and
it.
Forth. That way I can keep the last page and catch up if I have.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. This is the second page. Self-existent, self-explanatory.
I think I'm
self-generating. Self-directing. What?
Operator.
Oh my God. Okay, I'm sorry. Oh really? Okay. Okay, I'm sorry for saying operating. It's kind of the same idea though, right? Okay, so these are the right ones. I don't know why I said operating. Because I don't have operating down right here. So I'm just making up stuff. What's that? Sarah? Okay, sorry. Thanks, Steve. Self-existent, self-explanatory, self-generating, and self-directing. So all I'm saying is it does everything by itself. It does everything by itself. And this is just a definition that you're going to see everywhere. This is part of it. And again, you're going to find we're going to have a lot of these to explain naturalism. The second part of naturalism is that the world processes are not teleological or anthropocentric, but purposeless and deterministic. Purposeless and deterministic. Does anybody want me to write that down here? Yes,
sure.
Or no?
Yeah.
Deterministic. The first one's purposeless. Second one's deterministic. So these processes are not teleological, meaning they don't have an end goal in mind. That's what teleological is. It's designed for a purpose of something in the future. And anthropocentric, there's nothing having to do with a God here or some human conception of God. But it's purposeless. It's deterministic. That's what the world's processes are in the naturalistic worldview. And every aspect of human life is an ordinary natural event attributable to nature. Ordinary natural event attributable to nature. Okay, so everything's just natural and everything is because of nature. So me standing up here talking, moving my arms like a dork like this, it's all attributable to nature. It's something happening in my brain. It's biochemistry. It's not me as a free agent with free will choosing to move my hands and look like a nerd. I am just doing this because there's some biochemical process that's deterministic. It's just doing its thing with no goal in mind. It's just causing me to do it. The lion attacks the zebra because a biological process is in place that's causing him to do that. He's not choosing it. I'm not choosing my words right now. Biochemistry is forcing me to do it. It's deterministic. It's determined to do its thing with no free agent or free will in mind. Now, the second part of this is I'm going to give you the key components to the naturalist account of the world. So that was kind of the basic definition. But these are the key components to the naturalistic worldview. So kind of getting into it a little bit more. Naturalists deny that the supernatural exists. Naturalists deny that miracles are possible. Naturalists deny that humans have freedom and purpose. Deny is all those. They deny all those things. Those are not real. And naturalism includes scientific determinism, which we just mentioned. But Stephen Hawking, one of the world's leading cosmologists, says, given the state of the universe at one time, a complete set of laws fully determines both the future and the past. This would exclude the possibility of miracles or an active role for God. We'll skip B just for the sake of time. In the case of people, Stephen Hawking says, since we cannot solve the equations that determine our behavior, we use effective placebo, make-believe, wishful thinking theory that people have free will. People think they have free will. We talk about it because it's custom. We have no other way to describe ourselves and our actions, so we'll just let it slide. But in reality, it's all just a bunch of biochemical processes that are undirected with no teleological purpose. And there are no miracles with the exception of the laws of nature, or exceptions to the laws of nature. Okay, so that's Stephen Hawking giving us some definitions. Naturalist account, this is another key component, naturalist account for the alleged problem of ethics and the alleged problem of mind. Ethics and mind. They account for these alleged problems. Now, what is ethics? Ethics is just a branch of philosophy that talks about why, what is the good, and good and evil, what those things are, and what is a good action, and what does it mean to do the good, and how do we do good if we have two alternatives? What do we do? Do we do the one that's the most good for the most people or for ourselves? Or what about two bad alternatives only? Do we do the worst, the lesser of two evils? How do we make that choice? That's kind of the ethics. And the alleged problem of mind. And what is that? Well, I'll kind of explain this idea of problem of mind here. Reducing the mind to brain functions and reducing ethical judgments to social customs or emotional expressions, which are natural processes that can be subjected to scientific investigation or reductionism. Meaning that, the first part there, reducing the mind to brain functions and reducing ethical judgments to social customs. So what is happening here is the naturalists say that the mind is just a brain. The mind is just the brain. It's a matter. The mind is just matter. It's like this. It's not a real separate entity that Christians call the soul. The Christians say the soul is equivalent to the mind and the will. And if you're a trichotomist theologian, you'll say that it's also part, the spirit is also part of that. So the Christian says that the soul consists of three faculties, the mind, the will, and including the emotions, and the spirit. Now, if you're a dichotomist Christian, you're going to say it's just the mind and the will. But either way, Christians kind of think of mind and soul interchangeably in terms of philosophy. And so the naturalist will say, there's no soul. It's just your brain. You don't have a mind. You just have something you call a mind. But it's really just your brain. So they reduce the mind to just the brain. So this picture frame is talking about the gates of Jerusalem. It's showing you the Damascus Gate, Herod's Gate, the New Gate. But the naturalist will say, no, it's not. That's just colors on paper. It's just matter. And matter has this property of being exemplifying itself greenly to you. And so they say that that's just paper. You just say that there's meaning on it. But it's really just matter. And that's what they say about our brain. They just say, no, it's just your brain. It's just neurons firing. It's just because they're predetermined causes and effects and causes and effects that can be traced all the way back to the beginning of time, the Big Bang. All of these causes and causes and causes just is causing you to do things right now. It's causing you to write. It's causing me to wave my hands. These are just biochemical causes that can be traced back from the beginning of time, just like the lion going after the zebra. And so they say your brain is just, your mind is just your brain. And ethical judgments are just social customs. It's just how we get along and interact because of evolution kind of being part of our social environment. It's this idea of social sociobiology. That's how they put it. And point one here, to say that something is wrong ethically is reduced to the agreement or disagreement with natural cultural customs. So when we say, no, you can't kill that baby, that's wrong. Well, that's just a natural social custom. It's not really wrong in all possible worlds, objectively wrong. It's just because we all as a group say it's wrong. They say, to say that someone is having pain, I'm in pain right now. That idea is reduced to the statement about or relating to or relating the natural process of his or her brain's neurofiber activity, brain experiencing this sensation called pain. So what they say is, when I say I'm in pain, the naturalist says, no, really, you're not in pain. What you mean is that your brain is experiencing this neurofiber activity, all these things firing around in your head, and it's creating this sensation, and you just call it pain out of social custom. So this is how the naturalists account for these actions. They reduce them. That's the idea, is they reduce it to matter in motion. Eliminating the correspondence between concept and reality. This is called eliminativism. And this is just to say that something is wrong is nonsense, as there are no real right or wrong properties that can be tested by science. You can't say that's wrong, because you can't test that with science. To say that I am thinking about X is nonsense, as there are no mental states or thoughts or beliefs. You're actually not thinking about scientific apologetics or this concept of naturalism right now. You are just having a bunch of neurons fire in your head, in your brain. You're not really thinking any thought. You just say you are, because that's social custom. And another key component of the naturalist worldview is naturalists avoid problems of an immaterial soul or an immaterial God relating and interacting with a material body and a material world. These are problems for the dualist and theist to resolve. What I mean by that is that the Christian has a burden of proof on him when he says, I am a soul, not I have a soul. The proper way to say it is, I am a soul, if you're a Christian. And the Christian says, there is a God. There's a burden of proof on the Christian. And the naturalist says, okay, Christian, prove to me you have a soul, prove to me there is a God, because you made that claim, you've got to prove it. Okay, fine. The naturalist position doesn't have to prove that. He has no burden of proof to show his position. He just says, there's no evidence for soul, there's no evidence for God, he's invisible. I can't taste, touch, smell, hear, or see him. There's no soul. I can't evaluate it with the five senses or with a scientific experiment. So in that sense, the naturalist position avoids the problem of the soul and the problem of God. And so that, I'm just telling you, that's the position. I'm just describing to you the position. That's all I'm doing. And last thing, and we'll head on out here. We'll go through this part four. Naturalists hail the successes of science as providing answers to problems that have plagued humanity. They say science has helped us cure polio. Okay? That's an awesome thing. They claim that superstition, appeals to mystery, and religion have muddied the waters instead of providing clear answers. We've got to get rid of this religion. Guys, it's superstition. Remember Steven Weinberg, that famous, at the first page last week, he said religious superstition. That's how he thinks of it. We must rid the world of that. If that's all we do as scientists, we've got to get rid of that and contribute to the human race. This is our contribution as scientists. And so that's a naturalistic perspective, of course. Not all scientists hold that. And that's what this is saying. This is that it's muddied the waters. It's made a mess of human development. Naturalists blame their allegedly anti-science opponents for being lazy thinkers who divert attention to the supernatural instead of finding natural answers to natural problems. So they say that anybody who doesn't love science, like we are anti-science, I'm not saying all of them. I'm saying some of them will claim this. And these anti-science opponents are just lazy thinkers. And they just divert attention and say it's from the supernatural instead of finding natural answers to natural problems. They say those people are lazy thinkers. And this was actually mentioned in a debate. Okay, and so for example, they would say that Christians or those who are anti-science would say, they say that that the anti-science people say mental illness being attributed to demons. So in the past, according to them, anti-science people said that mental illness is really not mental illness, it's a demon. That's how anti-science people used to think of mental illness. Now we know that there's chemical imbalances and such in your head, in our brains. Degrading the body, earth, and women due to an alleged spiritual inferiority. So proponents, naturalist proponents, say that those who are anti-science think that the body, the earth, and women aren't as good as, say, men. And we have this spiritual superiority. That's what they think we think. Or that's what at least some of them do. Another example is destructive weather patterns are due to the lack of favor of the gods. We talked about that. This has slowed human progress, caused great harm to people, and oppressed other cultures. Whereas naturalism has proved itself time and time again, and so they're confident in that, and all currently unknown issues will one day have a naturalistic solution. So although we don't know certain things now, one day science will get us there, and anybody who's anti-science doesn't hold that to be true. They just are lazy thinkers. That's kind of the idea here. So this is kind of the naturalist perspective, is that they are very excited about science, and science has done a lot. So that's the position of naturalism. Those are some of the key components. We'll look at some more of the key components of this worldview next time. And later on, we'll start to get into how this idea developed. How did the idea of naturalism and scientism develop? Where did it come from? We'll get into some Enlightenment thought, not in too much detail. But then we're going to start looking at the problems with this worldview. We're defining it now, and I'm leaving you hanging. But later on, we're going to look at the problems with this position. And we'll show some critiques and why it should be rejected. Any questions at this point? Okay, so we'll go ahead and close. Dear God, we just thank you for this time. Thank you for helping us think and this second class. And we pray that you would open our minds through the rest of this course to know your reality and your truth. In Jesus' name, amen.